You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, I'm very excited, delighted, honoured to actually welcome back to RCR Professor Bruce Hardy. He will be a name familiar to many on the radio show here or across the station. He is amongst many claims to fame, a professor of law at Queen's University, and that's in Ontario in Canada. He's the executive director of actually a very important think tank called Rights Probe. They look into questions of law and liberty. He's even, well, taught, lectured, been on the law faculty at Victoria University here in New Zealand, and he joins us this morning. Professor Hardy, thanks for coming along.
Oh, thanks for having me, Simon. Pleasure.
Hey, look, there's so much to cover, and just for listeners to understand, we're really wanting to look at sort of the interplay of how laws and particularly Western societies like New Zealand, Canada, the UK, Australia, sort of interplay in our democracy today. And I think, Bruce, if I might be so informal to call you that, you've seen a notable change. One of the things you've talked about quite clearly is you've talked about the rule of law having been replaced by the rule by law. And just wonder if you wanted to expand on that for some listeners, because they'll be going, hold on, what does he mean by rule of law being replaced by rule by law?
Right. Yes. So we all think we live in countries governed by the rule of law. And the rule of law is an idea, and it's a very good idea. And the idea is that the rule applies to everyone, both those who are governed and those who do the governing. And in many other respects, it represents a limitation on what governments are allowed to do. And it's an idea of very long standing. In a sense, it's one of the achievements of Western civilization. And yet, recently, and this has been a long time coming, actually, but you could see it come to a head, if you like, during COVID. That idea, the rule of law, has faded away. It's been replaced by another thing, which I like to call rule by law, meaning that governments now use laws as tools to achieve the specific objectives that they want to achieve. And the process and the safeguards that are contained within the idea of rule of law have basically been put aside. Let me give you one concrete example. One of the ideas behind the rule of law is that the functions of the state are separated, separation of powers. You know, the legislature makes the rules, the courts apply the rules to cases, and the executive branch, all those administrative agencies, they execute and enforce the rules. And that protects us because it means that nobody actually has all the power. It's all distributed, and there are checks and balances on each other. That's all well and good. Except that that's not actually the way it works now. The way it works is the legislature passes these statutes that delegate rulemaking authority to the executive branch. And so all these agencies now are the ones making all the rules in the regulations and the guidelines and directives. You saw this during COVID. You saw, you know, the prime minister or a public health official get behind a microphone on a Tuesday and say, right, well, the rule tomorrow is going to be X. Right? That is not the rule of law. That's rule by law. All you people, here's the new rule you will obey. And courts, for their part, have just gone along with this. And in fact, instead of restricting these agencies to their powers, as outlined in the statutes, have tended to defer to their expertise. And so you have all three of these branches doing the jobs of the other branches, and it's all a mess. And maybe the worst part is all three branches, for the most part, seem to be fine with this idea that the law is now a tool rather than being subject to this principle of the rule of law.
Thank you for articulating that. Having been inside the system, I can completely concur, particularly around that element of, we talk about primary legislation here. And so for listeners to understand, you know, when you're in Parliament, you pass a piece of legislation to say that X and Y should happen. And a really, really simple example would be, normally in older days, if I sound like a romantic, older days, the law would say, look, if we're going to do this piece of of work that should be reporting, and here are the 10 things that must be reported on. But modern laws now hand that over, as you were saying, Bruce, into regulation. So in other words, the primary legislation hands the power, the design work, the enforcement over to civil servants or bureaucrats to run. The politicians actually don't design the system. And I suppose that's an element of what you're describing there. The parliaments are handing enormous power over to, I think you've used the term, as others, a managerial state or a managerial class.
That's exactly right. The managerial state is what you get is you get policy decisions being made by the bureaucracy instead of by the politicians. I mean, the way it used to be expected is that policy decisions would be contained in legislation, and that process of deciding what those policy rules were going to be was deliberate in the sense that it happened in Parliament. Anybody could hear if they wanted. They could hear the debates, they could see the way people voted, and then they had an outcome. But now, just as often, the rules are made in back rooms, and there's no public deliberation, and they come out with a result. It's declarative, not deliberative. And it's much more difficult for the body public to exert democratic control over what happens in that realm, because those people are not directly elected or responsible to the citizens. And so you're one more step removed. And that's one of the many bits of the recipe for getting into real authoritarian trouble.
Yeah, and again, in sharing my own experiences to sort of illustrate what you're saying, is not to assuage or take away any of my responsibilities and any things which happen, but it is remarkable to me of just how much power is handed over effectively to the unelected. As you say, in times past, it was expected that the law, the primary legislation, that statute would be very clear, it would be very, yes, a deliberative, very clear what the parliament was thinking, why the vote went the way it did. It outlined everything in black and white. But now, as I say, a lot of law, look, this is a controversial and ethical topic. We have a euthanasia law in New Zealand that's like 23 pages long, and most of that sort of covering pages. And yet most of the decisions of how that operates has actually been given over, as I say, to ministries, to officials and bureaucrats. And you're going, well, it doesn't even matter what you think of the ethical issue. That's an enormous amount of power that's been given to, as you say, people who are unelected.
Yes. Yes, that's exactly right. And that applies to so many subjects. Most of them now, today, the power to decide in the end what's going to happen is being made at that level and not at the elected level. True, yes.
From your observation, is part of that because the elected, well, it enables them to sidestep in one way. Yes. I'm thinking out loud as we're talking here. We go, well, I passed the law, Bruce, but, you know, it was the bureaucrat down the road that decided to make the stupid reporting. Is there almost a deliberate intent there, you think?
Yes, I'm afraid there is. It's a way to duck.
Sorry.
It's a way to duck responsibility. You know, here's a concrete example, and it's a different realm. So I was a few years ago at an informal meeting at a public school, a junior school, that was slated to be closed. And the parents who lived in the area were unhappy with the decision. And one of the school board trustees who represented the area came to the meeting and said, you know, I support you in your objections to closing the school, but the administration has recommended this be done. And so our hands are tied and we can't really do anything about it. And I stood up and I said, that is not true. You are the trustee. You are the one to give the power to the administration and to accept or reject their recommendations. This is on you. You have the call. And the fact that you don't want to make it doesn't mean you're not actually making it. You are making it by default, by simply going along and giving the power to the administration that wants to take it.
Oh, a perfect illustration. I'm amazed at times, having been in government, having been in opposition, out of it now, but watching it is, yeah, the ability for actual decision makers and those who hold the power to say we're not responsible. But what amazes me, though, in that is and I want to go general here because it could be insulting to some, but it's amazing that society accepts this. I mean, is it that people are not aware of the dynamics in play? I suppose it's part of the reason, Bruce, we're having this conversation is that society seems to, by and large, accept that. When someone goes to a government minister and says, hey, we need this change, it's not working, they say, well, you know, I handed the power over, it's such and such responsibility now, I can't do anything, which is patently false. But most Kiwis sort of nod their head and go, oh, thanks very much. I mean, is that something that happens in Canada and elsewhere?
Absolutely. Yes. I'm afraid that there is now a wide expectation that we will have, and in fact, have to have, a need to have, an administrative state, a managerial state. That is, people think that government exists for these purposes. That is, we require an expert bureaucracy to help lead us through our lives, to manage this economy, to manage the society, to solve social problems. And if they don't have the ability to make these decisions, how are they going to do that? And so if you went up to somebody on the street and you said, you know, we shouldn't have an administrative state, assuming they knew what that was, they would probably look at you with surprise in their eyes and think, well, what do you mean? What else is government for? We've lost the idea that the government is a smaller thing that sets basic rules to keep us all protected from each other, from the intrusions of each other. That idea has sort of gone out the window.
How do you think we got there? Because look, I concur with that. My academic background's more in philosophy, and what amazes me is one of the principles. Well, there's so many principles in philosophy, is what they call subsidiarity, which is the whole, you know, each of us makes decisions up to our level of competence. And so governments, as you say, can make big, big decisions. And someone like myself, I can make a decision of how I want to live, the relationships I want to have, how I educate my children, et cetera, et cetera. But it seems to have become very blurred, and certainly the likes of New Zealand, from what I can see of Canada, Australia, that now the state has its say in almost all realms of, it's everywhere. It is just everywhere. And we, again, and I probably include myself in this, we've sort of accepted it to many degrees that, the government just has to solve this problem. You go, well, why don't you get off your own backside and do something about it yourself in your own individual ability?
Right. Well, I come to think that this is, we are at a stage in a very long process of transitioning from a liberal society to a post-liberal society. And by liberal, I don't mean progressive lefty. I mean liberal in the original Western civilization sense of the word, in the sense of
freedom,
supporting the idea that people are essentially autonomous over their own lives, and they get to make their own decisions, and they have to live by them. That idea is still around. I mean, we haven't lost it altogether. But it's in conflict with the competing idea, which is actually it's the job of the state to keep us all safe, including and especially from our own foolish decisions. And once you get into a post-liberal mindset or paradigm, then you find that a lot of the older ideas that we take for granted in our system, rule of law and consistency in legal decisions and representative democracy and equal application of the law and all of those associated ideas that the Western liberal idea represents, those ideas are being threatened by opposite ideas in this new paradigm, which is partly why I think things seem so incoherent now, because that battle has not been resolved yet.
Well, I think for a lot of people, they would, again, it's only my sense, that they feel something's wrong, but they're not able to well articulate it, which is why we bring people like yourself on and have these conversations to try and alert people. Because you mentioned a couple of things there, like representative democracy. I mean, I believe in it, but I'd make the case, and feel free to comment, that in many ways we're ending up with a managerial class of representatives. We're seeing much more, if you will, almost professional politicians and not the broad range of, I don't know, teachers, farmers, engineers, ex-military. It's becoming less representative. And the other is when MPs or senators hand power over to bureaucrats, they're no longer representing, arguably, are they?
No, they're not. No, and I don't, and I would prefer a system in which they did not have the power to do that. But I think your point is quite right. We have a professional managerial class, and that class includes these long-term politicians, but it also includes the bureaucrats who have power inside this managerial state. And you can tell that we are into this transition, the transitioning from sort of a liberal free market system to a post-liberal planned economy managed society system this way. Just think about who the elites are in this society now. Sure, you still have a few people who have achieved their status by competing successfully in the marketplace. You know, you have the Elon Musks of the world. But for the most part, the elites now are members of this professional managerial class that you're mentioning. Those are the people who control things. Those are the people who make the calls about what's going to happen. And if you want to be powerful in this society, you are much less likely to be or aspire to be an entrepreneur than to aspire to be somebody who's embedded deeply in the institutions and agencies that make the calls for on society's behalf.
I think you're quite right, and two things for me illustrate that. Actually, when they do surveys here in New Zealand about where young graduates from university want to work, the majority want to work in the bureaucracy, which even in my short time is quite a flip around. When I was finishing university, everyone wanted to get into the corporate or the private sector.
Yes,
Now it's the other way around.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. And frankly, that's what an awful lot of our graduates, most graduates, are trained to do now. They're much better equipped to be bureaucrats than they are to be entrepreneurs. That's the way they think. That's what they're equipped to do.
Well, put it crudely, and dare I say it to someone who's at a university, but a lot of universities now don't strike me as the traditional platform for a good liberal, as in free education in terms of breadth of ideas. They're becoming very, very narrow as a whole. As a whole, I have to stress, because there's, of course, still amazing professors and lecturers. But certainly here in New Zealand, a lot of our universities are just pumping out, I call them automatons. They're basically just indoctrinated in a very particular way of thinking, and they don't have that creativity that would work, I would argue, in the corporate or private sector.
I don't disagree. I agree with you that there are exceptions still, but for the most part, a lot of the trouble that we are running into today, I think, can be laid at the feet of universities, which have adopted, they're the first institutions to adopt a certain number and flavor of ideologies, and they've stuck to it, and it's spread throughout the disciplines, and they have taught generations of students. They've taught the ideology to them, you know, the critical theory and the social justice and all those things that go along with those ideas. But also, these students have been taught that the most important thing to be doing is to be thinking about policy. Now, policy is a thing that the managerial state does. To do policy means that you think that your job is to think up rules for other people to follow. That's what policy is. And so if you aspire to a policy career, that means you aspire to having a career in which you are in an office making up rules for other people to follow. And that's what our government has become.
Yeah, and having not been in policy, but been in government or in politics, I am amazed just how many policy advisors there are. Often, not always, but often thinking, as you say, about how to create more rules and regulations for me to live my life. It's like, oh my God. Also then a whole lot of spin doctors to try and communicate that policy in a way that sort of makes us comply, for want of a better word.
Right. And sure, and this goes back to the idea of what they think they're there for. And this is genuine. I've talked to so many of these people, both professors and students and people who are in the middle of their careers. A lot of them genuinely believe that their mandate is to manage society, which means that the individuals in the society have to be managed as well. And if there are some things, some behaviors that they regard as necessary in order for the management a goal to be achieved, well, then that's the role of the policy. They really think, some of them, that they are the ones with expertise. And because they have expertise and other people do not, they are the ones that rightly should and have to tell the rest of us what to do.
Oh, it scares the bejesus out of me. I mentioned earlier, you know, philosophy has been a big part of my academic background, theology as well. And the only reason I mentioned that, Bruce, is we sort of went through that moral certainty of the church, for example, in the Middle Ages, which thought it was right, it had the only view of life. And that didn't turn out to be a particularly peaceful or bloodless affair, shall we say. And I don't want to draw the analogy too far, but I sort of see echoes of it now, because you've touched on a couple of things for me. One is there's this moral certainty, I would add, to those.
Yes.
Not only do they think they're right, they morally believe they are the good and right people, and therefore they want to create, I'm going to use that word, utopia, which scares me even further, anyone who's got a utopian view. And part of it is the collective now is more important than the individual. And you saw that certainly in COVID times. Your individual rights went out the window to protect the collective.
I think you're dead on. I think this is part of the transition that I was describing. So if you think of, this is very broad brush stroke stuff. But if you think of a very slow moving pendulum starting in a world before liberalism, like a pre-liberal world that had the characteristics you're describing, sort of a church-led moral certainty world where those beliefs are enforced, you better behave or you'll be in real trouble because you're a heretic. And then we swing into the liberal view, and that has lasted, thankfully, for a good amount of time. And it was never pure, but it certainly had those characteristics. But now I think, exactly as you say, we are swinging back, not into something that's exactly the same, but something that has characteristics that are more like the pre-liberal world than like the liberal world that we thought that we lived in.
Yeah, I often describe it as, for me, it's parallels. It's not exactly the same. When people say, you know, history repeats, it doesn't for me mean it's exactly the same, but there's parallels. You know, stepped against church authorities in the 1500s, we'd burn you alive. Now we pillory you in the public square, destroy your career, and besmirch your name. Parallels. But I mean, is there an element that our modern societies don't appreciate the extraordinary, I don't know, I was going to say, is it patrimony? The freedoms we have are unusual in the course of history. You know, Western civilization, democracy, freedoms, rights, the ability to speak, believe where you want. These are extraordinary. These are not how most societies work, nor is it the way that the world worked for most of its recorded history. I mean, do we just not appreciate what we've got?
I think that's very possible. And this is perhaps the problem with the pendulum analogy. If we're lucky, it might be a pendulum. If we're unlucky, this liberal period is just an aberration. And as the exception to the rule, who knows? You know, once it's gone, it might be gone. And people who have lived through it don't appreciate that the unusualness of it. It is remarkable, given what has happened over the rest of history and human civilization. This liberalism thing is a remarkable achievement. It is the thing that Western civilization should be most proud of, and yet that is the thing that's now being attacked. And how robust it will be, who knows?
Well, this is the cruel irony as I sit back and ponder. It's exactly that. It's amazing what has been created. Now, the core freedoms, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of belief, freedom of association, freedom of movement, you know, the for me, the big fundamentals. And yet those are the exact ones which are now completely under fire. And we're being told day after day that our Western civilization, even that's under critique of whether it even existed, but that's another whole rabbit hole. It's just like, oh my God, how are we undermining our very selves, these fundamentals. I mean, do you think that's something from without in a strange way, or is this part of, or is this a symptom of that managerial, I don't know, utopian dynamic that's coming from within?
Yeah, it's hard to say. My guess would be the latter, but it's very hard to say. But I trace it back to a mistake that we made. And when I say we, I mean our predecessors, over a long period of time. You know, the rule of law was very long in coming. You might date it back to the beginning, back to maybe the Magna Carta in 1215. It took hundreds of years and a great deal of conflict. And we got to a place where we thought that we had established the ground rules. So to allow this rule of law idea to continue, to persevere. And yet, it turns out that our constitutional orders are not so robust as to be able to prevent those who would undermine it from doing exactly that. So we made some kind of mistake. When we had the chance, we didn't go far enough so as to make sure that the powers of those who govern were really restricted. Because you can see it today, they're not restricted really at all, because they've only been held back by an idea. And once the people in power don't believe in the idea, then the idea doesn't matter anymore. And that I think, is what's happening now.
Oh, 100% agree. I'm amazed when we talk or even lecture at unis around a lot of this stuff to the younger ones. God, I sound like an old man now picking on them. But yeah, the state that we are in now with these freedoms, by and large, these liberties were very hard won, as you say. They were fought for. But I think a lot of them seem to believe that this is just the natural state of being. I mean, obviously, this is the very Hobbesian, well, the alternative, the Hobbesian view, that, you know, a state of nature, chaos. You know, right. What we've created is actually quite remarkable, and it didn't just happen by accident. You know,
no,
it's taken a lot of hard work, but they think it does. Yes.
Yeah, no, agreed. Agreed. It's, you know, that saying, you don't know what you've got till it's gone.
You mentioned just quickly in passing about the law is there to protect individuals, but to limit the power of those in power. So a very awkward sentence. You know, when I look around the world at the moment, we have, if you will, more and more of these celebrity leaders. And, you know, it doesn't matter if you're talking Harris or Trump, or you've got Trudeau, we've had Jacinda Ardern, that we are getting more and more powerful leaders in and of themselves. And they're overshadowing, and almost to a degree, I would argue, that the systems, their ministers and everybody else. That, you know, you talked about the 1 a.m. or 1 p.m. In here in New Zealand, where political leaders would get up, and pretty much one political leader, and tell us what was happening. I mean, is that a sign? That's probably what I'm trying to get at. When you talk about the law is meant to be protecting individuals, limiting the power of individuals in power, yet at the same time we are seeing a greater celebrity politician. Is that a sign that things are around the wrong way?
Yes, you know, it's funny because it's a bit of a chicken and egg.
Yep.
Right. So during the pandemic, for example, there were two versions of outrage about how the rules were being made. And one of those, and they were opposites. So one version was, you know, the politicians are interfering with the decision-making process of the public health authority. I mean, how dare a politician stick his nose into the business of the public health authorities, who are the ones who know what they're supposed to be doing? And then you had the opposite one, which was, how could it be that an unelected public health official is making the rules about what we can all do without the direction of the politicians, who are the ones who are elected? Right? So those both seemed bad. And yet they were opposites. And I think the answer is, well, those, you know, these kinds of rules shouldn't be made in either one of those ways. Again, you're supposed to be making them in legislatures. The politicians themselves are not supposed to have the control to be making up rules on the spot. But for that matter, neither is the public health doctor, the lead, the public health official, the chief medical officer, they're not supposed to have that kind of power either. We're not supposed to have these kinds of rules at all. This kind of rulemaking process itself is wrong, and it doesn't matter whether or not the final say behind the mic is a politician or a public health official.
Yeah, well, down here we seem to be able to fuse both of those together. We had sort of the technocrat, and the politician. I mean, to be blunt, the system at one level did fight back eventually, and that most of the rules and regulations were actually tossed out over time. The court said no, that was illegal, shouldn't have happened. And why I mention that, Bruce, is it's extraordinary that at one level the system, to a degree, a bit too late in the process, but it did push back, and yet still, I suppose, just an observation my end, that the general public, they don't mean literally rioting in the streets, that's not what we want, but going, hold on a moment, what happened here? As you say, this managerial class passed a whole lot of laws, affected our lives, it was found to be by and large illegal, and people go, oh well, too bad, off to the beach.
Yeah, it's right.
Maddening.
Yes, there's been no reckoning, and it doesn't look likely that there will be a major reckoning from here. I can't see it, because most people, as you say, don't seem to care, and certainly the people who were in charge don't want one. So that means that there's been no lessons learned and nothing taken from it, and the path that we were on, and both before but especially during COVID, is the one that we're still on.
I do find it extraordinary. I suppose it's more the psychological side of things, which be difficult to go down. I mean, do you feel, and it's a slight, it's not quite a contradiction, but when I look at that legal system, and I think you may have talked about this before, when people go to the courts these days, I think there's a general perception they expect the court to decide what's right or wrong. Whereas, and I'm no legal professor, but the courts now really are looking towards the policy or what the parliament has said. So when people do go to the judge and say, hey, it's absolutely terrible what's happened to me, surely this is wrong. In many ways, to me, the judges are sort of saying, well, yeah, it is wrong, but the law says that this bureaucrat behind the desk, who we don't know the name of, has made a regulation, and that action's perfectly legal. Is that a very crude but fair comment?
Yes, that's a fair comment about what largely happened during COVID, certainly in this country. But it's a little bit selective, too. So to your first point, I agree that many people think that the role of the courts is to pass judgment on whether or not the rules are good or not. And that's really, I mean, if you're in a liberal system of the rule of law and precedent and restrained courts, as they're supposed to be, that is not the function of the court. The court is to do as you described, which is to assess whether or not the rules as passed by Parliament have been obeyed.
Yep.
But the courts have been selective in their approaches too. So they will take that approach, and did largely during COVID, which is to say, no, the statute gives that power to this official, that official did that, and therefore it's fine. There are lots of other situations with, you know, different subject matter, different policy implications, different ideology even, where the courts have done the opposite, which is to say, well, you know, that legislation or that policy rule is, you know, in our country would be against the Charter, or in your country against the Bill of Rights, and therefore we won't have it. It has to be X and not Y. So both things are happening. Courts are restrained in some moments because they don't see any problem with what's going on, and they are activist in other moments because they see themselves as policy bodies. So you can't count on the courts taking one or the other approaches, because they choose which approach, they seem to approve to choose which approach they want in any particular case.
I'm pleased you say that. I mean, that's my observation. Again, I am not a legal scholar. I'm not a man of the law per se, but I do see very arbitrary decision-making now. Almost, we talked earlier about policymakers, managerial class, making moral decisions. They believe they're right. And I think I'm seeing that in certainly in the New Zealand courts, they are making a moral set of decisions of what they will and won't pursue. They've even introduced whole new concepts into New Zealand's law that haven't been legislated for over here. It's the Māori tikanga, and again, that's another whole rabbit hole. But Parliament had no say in it. The courts have just brought it in. I mean, is this arbitrariness? Is this tension? And I would argue even a breakdown of comity. Is this a sign that the system is not working the way it's meant to?
Yes. Yes. Oh, I would say that for sure. And this weakening of the idea both of restraint and of precedence, that is consistency, coherence, has been going on, I think, for a long time, but it is increasing. And those characteristics are part of a post-liberal order. See, this is one of the criticisms that people like you and I make about the world that is becoming. We say you're not being consistent. You're not being coherent. You made a different decision today than yesterday. The thing is, though, that in this new paradigm, that doesn't matter. That is not one of the values. Consistency is out the window. The idea there is, no, you consider each case on its own facts, and we'll decide each individual day for each individual group of people what the proper thing to do today is. And consistency be damned.
Oh, it's what drives me mad. I'm surprised I haven't had a coronary yet, because it was one of the things trained into me philosophically is consistency. That's what you look for. And now, as you say, there's just an arbitrary day by day. And it's just like, well, ultimately, if we go down this line, we're not going to have a rule of law. We're going to return to just basic power. Who's the person who's got enough power to exert their influence to make today's decision the right or wrong one? I mean, do you think that's one of the reasons why we've got all these laws, we've got a plethora of regulations. Now we need oversight bodies, we need commissions and ombudsmans and tribunals and codes of conduct. I can just go on and on, but we seem to have to craft a structure or a system now to manage that arbitrariness. I don't know if that's a fair observation or makes sense.
Yeah, well, there's an irony here, and more than one, but the one I'm thinking of is this. As you suggest, we have laws and regulations and guidelines and directives about everything, and yet everything also seems to be arbitrary. I mean, yeah. How do those two things go together? How is it that you codify everything, and yet you can't, the regular person can't count on knowing what the rule is going to be, right? So you've got both things simultaneously, and it's remarkable that they can coexist, but they can.
They do. Can I just say, I mean, look, again, you're the expert in this space. That's just beautifully said. It's exactly that, which, amongst other things, does my head in. Bruce, I am conscious of your time, so I just wanted to raise one other. You've said many, many things, not only in this interview, but over the years. But as the philosopher in me has loved a distinction that you've been discussing at times between the ought and must, and that society is moving from an ought approach to a must approach. I wonder if you just wanted to talk us through that briefly.
Sure. Yes. So lots of people, including philosophers, love, and quite rightly, love to discuss how people ought to behave. I mean, it's a very interesting and valuable thing to think about and to write about and to read about and to debate. How should people behave? How ought they to behave? But what's happening more today is that people are insisting that the way they think people ought to behave is the way the law must require them to behave. In other words, you're not supposed to have a choice here. Ought means you have a choice. Must means the law will make you. And yep. And we have traditionally had those two different realms of inquiry, the philosophical and the legal, and they're now being conflated. And that's a very dangerous thing, because that means the powerful will aim to enforce their own individual, personal, moral inclinations on the rest of us. And that means our freedom goes out the window.
We're certainly seeing that more and more in New Zealand, particularly in those moral, ethical areas, which are always fraught. I mean, I used to argue this in the parliament and with colleagues in caucus, is that, you know, the more moral, if you will, or the more ethically fraught an issue is, of course it's going to be more and more tense. But that's in that ought approach, you know. I might have my view of what should or ought to be done, but I respect that someone will have a different view and they've got their view of what ought to be done, and we're going to talk and discuss and contest it. But we are seeing more and more laws in New Zealand which are, to use your term, must. You must think this way. You must act this way. And if you don't, well, heavy fines are off to prison. And it's, I would argue, it's manifesting quite profoundly here in New Zealand around debate around free speech and hate speech laws. And I know Canada, is it C-63?
C-63 here.
Yeah.
Yes, it's happening. It's happening everywhere. But I mean, I think the place you can see it perhaps most acutely at the moment is the UK. I mean, suddenly that seems like a different country. Like, what is going on?
Agreed. Well, it is. I mean, I've been shocked, certainly in the last few months. It very much is that must, isn't it? You have to think a certain way, you have to speak a certain way. I mean, speaking to you as a legal professor, is there an element of and I'm probably going to phrase this wrong because it's not my area of expertise, but it's sort of what I think I've heard referred to as legal positivism. In other words, that if the law says something is okay or it's not, then that consequently becomes the moral thing. Though the law defines what is right and wrong. And again, if you've got this managerial class and we've decided, God damn it, Bruce and Simon, this is what we're going to think on a topic, and the law says that's what we've got to think, then you've got to abide by it because it's now the moral and right thing to do.
Well, yes and no. I mean, so positivism has also been used, though, to inform the way courts should behave. So if you're a positivist in that realm, you believe that the courts simply apply the rule as it's written, as opposed to inquiring into whether or not they think the rule is okay. And I mean, I wouldn't call myself a positivist for sure, but I do believe in restrained courts. I believe in courts that are applying rules instead of making them up. But I take your point, though. I take your point in the sense that the law is now taking on the role of defining society's morals. And for my money, that's a thing that people should be doing for themselves.
Yep. For me, it's the proper role of governments to provide, I don't know, a ballpark, a very broad framework. I mean, we traditionally think that is, again, liberal rights and freedoms, and then within that, individual citizens and families, communities can make their decisions. But we're seeing, I use that word subsidiarity much earlier, that actually government stepping in more and more and more into our private life's decisions as though what I'm allowed to think, what I'm allowed to believe. It's like, well, hold on a moment. You used to say, keep out of the bedroom, and now here you all are. Get out.
That's right. So I like to think of it this way. So the reason for having a state at all is so that it can protect us from each other. So the one thing we don't want the freedom to do is to go around beating each other up and stealing our stuff, right? You got to have peace. And you need, and the theory goes, you need a state for that. You need a state with some power to make sure that you don't have somebody on the rampage. You have to look somewhere to keep the peace. But the problem is that once you create a state with the power to do that, then it also has the power to do other things. And if things go badly, as they're going now, the state overreaches that role and starts to interfere in all kinds of other stuff. And then finally, you lose sight of why it is you have a state in the first place, which is what's happening now.
As you're speaking, it reminds me of one of a quotes. It's from a book called A Canticle for Leibowitz by Walter Miller.
Right.
It's always had quite a profound... Yeah, he writes at one point, you know, it's right and proper for the state, I'm paraphrasing, but right and proper for the state to minimize suffering and maximize security. But in seeking both, we found the opposite.
Right.
And for me, that's always run true as governments, states, judiciaries, whoever, bureaucrats, policymakers seek to, minimize harm. We've got to have more and more security, more rules, more regulations. They're making the opposite. We're actually less... I think we're less hopeful. So, I mean, how do we How do we turn this around? Can we turn it around? Let's put it as a dramatic question. Can we turn this around?
Well, I think in theory we could. I think there are other ways that we could organize ourselves so that this kind of thing doesn't happen. Yes. But whether that is politically pragmatic, practical, possible, I don't know. I mean, you might know that better than me. Is it possible in today with the mindset that a lot of people have now and their attitude towards government, is it possible to rouse them in sufficient numbers for them to say, look, we don't want this system anymore. We want something different. We want not necessarily to go back to something, because once you leave something, it's hard to go back to. But we want to change it so that it is more attuned to protecting our freedom than invading it.
Yep. I'm hopeful but not optimistic is my answer.
Right.
To that, I'm hopeful insofar as, you know, certainly in my, even the work I'm doing now on RCR and other advocacy is still filled with hope that we can change it. We can wake enough people up. We can educate people enough. But I'm not as optimistic as I'd like to be, because I'm amazed at times of just how many people are either unaware. And to be fair on them, Bruce, life's busy. They're running about trying to, you know, keep their job, look after their kids. But there's also a mindset that an indoctrination that's coming through with a lot of people that just don't, well, something like free speech, to go, well, why should you, Simon, be allowed to say something I disagree with? It hurts my feelings. It's like, grow up.
Yep. And it may be that we are now on our way on some kind of civilizational arc that needs to play out. I don't know if we can just turn around and go, you know, go back some other place, even change direction. If you've got some... Society in some ways is like a huge ship. You know, you just can't turn on a dime. You have to let the momentum play out, and then you can figure out where you are. But if that's true, then we're in for a real rough patch before we have the chance of maybe trying to smooth things out.
That's sort of where I land. I often talk about it's like trying to turn a giant oil super tanker around. You can do it, but it takes a lot of time. And, you know, to stretch the analogy, maybe it's a bit like the one that got stuck in the Suez Canal. We've got to bang into the sides a few times.
Yeah.
Bruce, I am exceptionally grateful for the amount of time you've given. And quite literally, I could certainly keep talking to you for hours, but you have a life and a job. So finally, how do people find out more about your work? I know Rights Probe is something quite significant in that you lead. How do people find out more about your work?
Thank you, Simon. Thanks for the question, and thanks for having me on. We have a website, rightsprobe.org. All our work is featured there, and they can also follow me on Twitter if they wish. I'm at Party Bruce.
Well, guys, I really encourage you to do so. Jump onto rightsprobe.org, go onto Bruce's X or Twitter account, see what he has to say. Bruce, so much. Very, very grateful for all the time and insights you've given us once again. So thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me, Simon. It's been a pleasure.
So that was Professor Bruce Pardy. He's a professor of law at Queen's University in Ontario in Canada, and he's also the executive director of Rights Probe. It's a law and liberty-based think tank.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.